Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Natalia Shpilova-Said, and this is an East European Studies podcast. Today, I'm speaking with Sarah Phillips, author of Disability and Mobile Citizenship in Post-Socialist Ukraine. Dr. Phillips is professor of anthropology at Indiana University Bloomington. Her previous publications also include a book-length study, Women's Social Activism in the New Ukraine. Hello, Sarah. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Natalia, for the invitation.
The book we are discussing today opens up a vast area of questions, as the topic itself is multi-leveled. It includes not only social concerns, but political, historical, economic, cultural. It also touches upon the identity formation, mentality specifics, the individual and the nation in general. I would also like to add that your research offers insights into psychology. A number of episodes and cases that you describe in this book are very moving. Tell us about your journey to this publication. What triggered your interest? How did it develop? Why did you choose Ukraine as a study case?
Sure. Wow. That's a very complex and wonderful question that could lead me down all kinds of avenues. So thank you for that. I have been doing research in Ukraine for almost all of my academic career. So this particular study, as you mentioned in your introduction, was preceded by other work that I carried out in Ukraine on issues of gender, issues of health. I have studied the Chernobyl nuclear accident and effects on health and people's thinking about health and medicine. And I've also been very interested in social movements in Ukraine. So this particular project on people with disabilities and the disability rights movement really follows on the heels of a lot of my previous research. And in some ways, I see it as the culmination of many of my different interests. The ways that I got connected to the communities of people with disabilities in Ukraine is that for my previous study, which was my PhD dissertation in anthropology, which I completed at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. My dissertation was focused on the life stories of women in Ukraine after the fall of the Soviet Union who had gotten into social activism and community organizing. So for that first book that you mentioned, which was a book that emerged from my dissertation on women's social activism in the New Ukraine, there was a handful of women whose lives of social activism I followed, and I got to know them and their families and their organizations and their communities very well. So, for instance, one of the organizations was a support group for families living in the capital city of Kiev who had so-called large families, so families comprised of three or more children. Was a group that they targeted for support because in the sort of waves of economic crisis after Ukrainian independence, they had identified these large families as in particular need, as having a very precarious existence and needing support. So that was one example. But another example that is more relevant to the current project is that I met a woman who was a social activist, and she had founded an organization to bring attention to the problems and the needs and the contributions, frankly, of people who had suffered traumatic spinal cord injury. She founded this organization, as she put it, to save her own son's life. So her son was 16. In the book, I call him Sasha. In the book, I call her Zoya. Those are not their real names. Mm-hmm. But he was 16. He had a diving accident, broke his neck, and became a quadriplegic. And so she was really devastated by this accident and what had happened to her son, but she was also very determined to do what she could to garner resources for him, help him survive, first of all, the trauma and get some rehabilitation, and then hopefully help him finish his education, get employed, and so on. So she founded this organization, and I profiled that organization somewhat. I really only touched on their organization, which I call Lotus, in that first book, very briefly. But it was through my connection with this woman, Zoya, and her son, Sasha, that really opened up for me this entire, at that time, kind of hidden world of people with disabilities in post-socialist Ukraine. And this would have been, let me think, when I first met this family. I think I first met them in 1997. So this was the late 90s. And I have been following their story ever since. So I can't believe I'm saying this almost, well, more than 20 years now. I've been in touch with Zoya and Sasha, and they have become, you know, good friends. But they really opened up for me this world of disability in a post-socialist country, and it's a world that at the time, and it would be interesting to hear if they would still characterize it this way, but at the time they referred to themselves as living in a parallel world. They felt like the world of having a disability, being a person with a disability, being a family with a disability, very rarely intersected with the world of quote-unquote non-disabled or quote-unquote normal people without disabilities. So that's how I came to the project, and it really brought together my interests in health issues, mm-hmm. my interest in social policy and how states are reshaping social policy after the fall of the Soviet Union, redefining citizenship, redefining what it means to be a citizen in these states of the former Soviet Union. It also touched on my interest in gender. Mm-hmm. Part of the book focuses on difference in the experiences between men and women with disabilities. And it was also very much an ethnographic project. You know, as an anthropologist, I'm really interested in people's stories. I'm interested in their narratives and how they narrate their experiences. So all of that came together in this project.
Yeah, I would like to discuss the term disability a little bit. Mm-hmm. In the introduction, you outline a theoretical scope and provide definitions of the terms that are central for this research. And disability or disable have other equivalents in Ukrainian, and it's invalidnost or invalid, which actually means not able or непридатний. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And this term became official during the Soviet period. I would say it was probably ingrained in the consciousness of Soviet people as well. And invalidnost is always associated with some stigma that produces for an individual numerous limitations. And I guess I'm combining two questions here, the history of the term invalidnost, and you also mentioned a linguistic tradition that goes back to the Russian Empire when people with disabilities, mental in particular, were described as юродивый. And another question, probably this one is a little bit broader, the Soviet heritage in terms of disability policies. And there is, I have one quote from your book, it's page 50. However, with the Bolshevik Revolution and the establishment of the Soviet state and the formal system of classification and administration of disability, the meaning of invalid changed to designate those Soviet citizens who had lost the capacity to work. So which means those people who are not useful anymore. So there was some like a very instrumental approach to the understanding of an individual.
Yes, yes, absolutely. You've really, Natalia, honed in on some very important points that I was trying to make in the book, and some important developments in official thinking about what it means to be an invalid or have invalidnost or be a person with a disability, and then I guess more activist thinking, more sort of first person experiences and negotiations of that. So let me just say a little bit about terminology. It's so interesting that you would bring that up, because that is an area where, even since the book was published in 2011, we have seen actually a lot of changes in Ukraine, both officially and in the popular discourse, and in particular in activist circles. So now, as far as I understand, with Ukraine having adopted the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of People with Disabilities in 2009, now in any official reference to disability policy, the word invalid should not be used.
Really?
Yes, in official papers, discourse, anything. It should be replaced with the term person with a disability. So I believe that means человек с инвалидностью, or людина с инвалидностью. And I do know that people first language is very much preferred in many activist circles. And so there's really a move towards not using identifiers or labels like invalid or spinalnik, so-called broken-backed person, I guess, or vizochnik, which would mean wheelchair user, in public discourse, and particularly for activists, there's a real move away from that kind of self-identification and identifying others with these labels, and a move towards people first language, like person with a disability or person who uses a wheelchair, person with a spinal cord injury. So that is a big difference that I have really noticed in the last few years. That's not to say that there isn't still a lot of debate about terminology. And of course, people have the right to refer to themselves however they want to, right? And so, you know, some people are more comfortable with identifying themselves with certain categories, certain labels, and actually do not appreciate the kind of what they might see as top-down, you know, directive or admonishment to change the way that they speak or refer to disability. But it's an ongoing conversation. Yes. So that's sort of thinking about terminology and how it's evolved and continues to evolve.
And the heritage of the Soviet Union, how they imposed this kind of understanding that those people who have,
yes.
who had some kind of disability, they were not just useful
right.
for the society, and it was quite exclusive. Right,
right. Mm-hmm. right. And as you know, again, this was a very uneven process. And so there are historians, you know, of disability in the Soviet Union that have looked at how this process of the Soviet state kind of sorting, you know, people, sorting different categories according to the state's definition of who was able to work, who was not able to work, what kinds of characteristics would lead someone to be able to take care of themselves versus needing помощь, right? Outside help. And there are some very interesting exceptions here too, right? So anytime you sort of see a rule, you also see an exception. So there are stories of people with disabilities who were very successful, you know, in the Soviet Union, and who didn't quite fit the mold of the kind of you know, exclusion, dejection, kind of demeaning of people with disabilities that maybe characterize more broadly what most people were experiencing. So I want to acknowledge those exceptions mm-hmm. is why I'm saying this. But yes, there was a classification system. There still is in Ukraine, although it has been modified. It has been amended in the Soviet Union that classed people into Group 1, Group 2, or Group 3, so-called invalids, based on their level of impairment, basically. And sometimes this meant that there were actually some groups of people with disability who had quite good access to employment and job training. There's some really interesting work that's being done right now by historians and folks in cultural studies looking at collectives of people with hearing disabilities or the deaf community in the Soviet Union and the work collectives that they formed and were very successful at, also communities of people with sight impairments along the same lines. So there were ways in which in the Soviet Union certain groups of people with disabilities formed communities, formed cultures of their own, and oftentimes that did involve a work aspect. You know, it was, after all, the workers' state. So defining oneself and one's social worth through work was very important in that context. For those who weren't so lucky and were not able to prove themselves able to work, or were not deemed as able to work according to the state's definition, unfortunately, as many of my interviewees would say, those people were, and this is to quote from one of my friends, given a pension, given a disability pension, and a license to do nothing. So oftentimes that meant that they were expected to survive on a very small disability pension, did not have opportunities for job training or employment, and often just were not in the public eye, were sequestered away either in families or maybe in an institution. So that's kind of the legacy that some folks are dealing with. And it's really these stigmatized notions of what it means to have a disability, what it means to be disabled, how having a disability figures into one's sort of worth as a citizen that a lot of disability rights groups now in Ukraine are trying to address. Right, so there's a lot of work to do, and it's being done to undo some of these legacies of kind of socialist approaches to disability.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was curious about the title of the book because it contains some like protesting stance against the prejudices that disability evokes. Disability, more often than not, means lack of or complete absence of mobility. So could you tell us a few words about the meaning of the title that you chose?
Yes, mm-hmm. So the title is, just to remind our listeners, Disability and Mobile Citizenship in Post-Socialist Ukraine. And the title really signals what, for me, I hope, is one of the major theoretical contributions of the book. There has been a lot of very interesting anthropological work of late on citizenship, how citizenship is defined in different political, socioeconomic contexts. And there's been, in particular, a lot of very interesting work on what does it mean to be a citizen in countries like Ukraine and Russia after the fall of socialist regimes. So I'm tapping into that literature and those discussions on citizen-state relations, really, and how those are being reworked. And I try to coin the term mobile citizenship to show how people with disabilities are tapping into innovative ways to define themselves as deserving, worthy, contributive, productive citizens in this new political, economic landscape in ways that maybe go against the notion that having a disability means that one cannot be physically mobile, but maybe more importantly, that one cannot be socially mobile. So it's kind of a play on words. Mm-hmm. And it also comes from the fact that the major population that I studied in my book is really the category or the group, the profile of people with disabilities who are probably most visible in the country, both physically and discursively. For historical reasons, people with mobility disabilities, including people who use wheelchairs, have really been at the forefront of the disability rights movement. And so this is a population that I focus on in the book. And so this notion of mobility becomes particularly important because we are talking both about physical mobility and the accessibility of the built environment, but we're also talking about social mobility and disrupting negative social attitudes, as well as putting, you know, the rights and the responsibilities and the contributions of people with all kinds of disabilities kind of front and center as we look at how social policy and definitions of citizenship have been revamped.
Mm-hmm. And probably this notion of mobility also includes some personal mobility because those stories that you describe, they are about people who actually lost their previous life, so figuratively speaking, metaphorically speaking, and they developed like new understanding of their own selves and new understanding of their friends. They lost their old friends, they acquired new friends. So would you tell us a few words about those stories that you actually included into your research, how that network developed?
Sure, sure, absolutely. And, you know, you're perfectly on point, Natalia, that, you know, the often traumatic experiences that people had and the people in the book became disabled at different times in their life cycles. But overall, yes, it's a very much a life-changing experience that leads people to talk about their lives before trauma and after trauma, or before disability and after disability. I mentioned the story of Zoya and Sasha, and I've really come to see that story actually as very indicative of the fact, and I think it still rings true in Ukraine today, that family support is absolutely critical to kind of predicting and shaping what a person's quality of life is going to be like after a traumatic injury, like a spinal cord injury. And so, you know, Zoya was a successful engineer. She had a very active social life. She's just an amazing interlocutor. She has so many interests and so many things that she loves to talk about. So she's a very vibrant person and had a lot going on. But when her son Sasha had his accident, she dropped everything. I mean, she her career was over. Her husband, they're more or less back together now, but the marriage had some very rocky times after the trauma. But you know, she really restructured her entire existence to take care of Sasha, to, like I said, found this organization and get the resources that he needed. An important thing about Zoya, though, is that she had so many friends that she could bring on board. So this, again, shows the importance of social networks, right? So tapping into one's existing networks for advice, assistance, was really important for her. She recognized that, and she also recognized her... Well, I guess Sasha's need for advice and understanding from people who had been in his situation. And she realized that there wasn't a strong network of people who had been through traumatic spinal cord injury that he could rely on. And so that became one of their organization's priorities, actually, was forming a kind of peer-to-peer network. So that was a really important function that their organization fulfilled. I think this is a good time to mention, actually, that a lot of the efforts of these early organizers in the disability rights movement in Ukraine were very impacted and inspired by colleagues who had come from abroad. Mm-hmm. So at this time, again, it's the you know, late 80s, early 90s, and then mid 90s when Zoya and Sasha were most active, I would say. And it was, you know, his trauma was newer at that time. They were in touch with proponents of a form of social empowerment and personal empowerment called active rehabilitation, or AR, who came from Sweden and from the Netherlands and from Canada. So there was a lot of you know, really productive, really fruitful collaboration between these groups from these other countries and people with disabilities in Ukraine, in Russia, in Poland. And she got a lot of her ideas from them. And, of course, for me as an anthropologist, it was interesting to look at you know, how she decided what aspects of these philosophies of active rehabilitation and independent living were pertinent for Ukraine and would work, and which ones she decided, you know, weren't quite matching up with local realities, and how she kind of, she and other activists piece together what they knew, their reality, and then the inspiration and ideas that they got from their colleagues abroad.
Mm-hmm. What's the role or function of the state in this process of developing new approaches to mm-hmm. this kind of policy?
Mm-hmm. It's a really interesting question. There is a very important figure in the disability rights movement, a politician and lawmaker called Valery Sushkevich. And really, in many ways, I see the disability rights movement as having coalesced around Sushkevich, who has held lots of different positions in the various administrations that have, run Ukraine, political administrations since the 90s. He was a member of parliament. He was head of the Inva Sport, so-called committee for sports. He still is head of the Paralympic committee. At present, I believe he is still the advisor to the president of Ukraine on disability issues. So he is a very, very central figure, and he has been very supportive of lots of these initiatives that I've been talking about. He really legislative reform right after the fall of the Soviet Union started with Sushkevich. He authored some of the new laws, the new disability protections that people saw. He has been involved in forming a coalition of disability rights organizations and really instantiating this program of active rehabilitation into state rehabilitation programs for people with traumatic spinal injuries. So in many ways, this linkage, right, that the activist communities have to the Ukrainian state through Sushkevich has been very productive, because it means that the energy, the ideas, the kind of best practices are being funneled into state programs and state approaches. It can also be somewhat problematic in having so much influence concentrated in one individual or in one group, sort of team, Sushkevich and his team. So it's a model that is not without its detractors and not without some potential pitfalls and problems. But it does mean that, ideas aren't just sort of tried out and tested out and then peter away, but that best practices are indeed being funneled over into the state's evolving approach to rehabilitation, education, job training. So I think there's actually a lot to be said for this kind of centralization in many ways, although not everyone is happy about it, of course.
So you traveled numerous times to Ukraine when completing this research, mm-hmm. and you were probably observing all these changes. But still, there are a lot of challenges today. For example, even in terms of equipment, I don't remember any bus in Ukraine, actually, which is equipped with some special facilities for those people who can get on bus on their own. In terms of education, probably as well. I'm not saying that it's completely impossible to get an education for a person with some disabilities, but still, that's what I'm curious about. In your research, you mentioned this concept of staring. when people are stared at, and this act kind of excludes them from other from others, so to speak. So, and I thought that it's very interesting because, well, when I was an undergraduate, I also saw people pursuing degrees with disabilities, but there was some sense of loneliness around them, and it, it's true that they were like excluded by this gazing. So how can this maybe, how this element, which is connected probably with mentality, be shifted in your opinion?
Great question. If I can quickly return to the first part of your remarks about accessibility and particularly accessible transport, it's still a huge problem. There are a couple, well, I shouldn't say how many because I haven't been keeping track lately, but there are increasing numbers of accessible buses, trolley buses, trams in major Ukrainian cities. There is now a wheelchair accessible fast train, for example, from Kyiv to Lviv, which is wonderful for those who can afford the fast train. As you know, there are different, you know, if you can... So the question of accessible transport is one that has been taken up on the national level, but I would say even more so at the municipal level. And so it's very interesting how Lviv, which, as you know, is a historical city, cobblestone streets, you know, in the center, and would not appear to be very disability-friendly, thanks to the efforts of some municipal, well, regional and municipal elected officials, has actually done a wonderful job of lobbying for and getting accessible transport for people who have mobility and other kinds of disabilities. So, that's one argument that I make in the book, is that sort of the example of these activists and their success in Lviv really shows the importance of getting people who understand disability issues elected into local offices, right? So positions of power at local levels. So that's sort of an aside to your question. But actually, the problem that you're talking about in terms of, you know, disability, people with disabilities being looked at as so different, maybe stigmatized, maybe they're pitied, right? They look lonely. Part of the problem is that even today you see so few of them. Right?
Yes.
And so, and that is connected not only to social perceptions, right? A fear of going out in public. It's connected to accessibility, right? The ability to actually get around, right? And actually occupy public spaces, right? And participate in social life. And so that's one of the things I was, trying to get at in the book by highlighting the creative ways in which some of the disability rights organizations that I worked with, particularly those for youth, I would say, really creatively inserted themselves into the public eye and took it upon themselves to, you know, to go out on the main thoroughfare in Kyiv, to show themselves to people, to get out, shake some hands, make some friends, really make a social connection so that, as they said, you know, people could meet a quote-unquote real live person with a disability, right? Part of the problem is that with the, you know, the social segregation that has characterized life for people with disabilities in places like Ukraine is that your, you know, quote, regular citizen very rarely has much opportunity to interact with a person with a disability. So I think that kind of intervention is really important. And that's, again, one of the reasons that the disability rights movement has really prioritized lobbying for accessible public spaces, accessible transport, not only so that people can travel to, you know, college, travel to the university campus, travel to work, but that they can occupy public space and participate in social life and put themselves out there as, you know, full-fledged citizens. So one of the recommendations that I made in the book is that, you know, groups should tap into more such opportunities, right, to facilitate these face-to-face interactions. And I think as inclusive education grows, and it is growing, however slowly, in Ukraine, now a child with a disability does have the right to study in a so-called regular school. So legislatively, that is the right. Whether or not that's being enforced and whether or not those laws are being supported financially is a whole other question. But I think as school children start to enjoy the benefits of inclusive education, as accessible transport and public spaces increase, and there's just more, you know, social mixing, mm-hmm. I think that that can make a big difference and help people see that, you know, disability is just one form of difference across the diversity of of human experience. And so I'm really hopeful that's going to progress in a positive way. I've been very impressed by the efforts of a young woman who, until very recently, was a news broadcaster on News One in Ukraine. Her name's Ulyana Pichulkina, and her husband is Vitaly Pichulkin. They're both vibrant, young disability rights activists who are wheelchair users, and I believe that Ulyana is really the public face of disability in Ukraine right now. She's very active and savvy in social media. So she's on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram. She's done public service announcements talking about, being a woman with a disability and encouraging others to get out in the public eye. So I think more efforts like that could really be helpful. Ukraine has been so very successful in the Paralympic competitions, particularly in the last Paralympic Games. I mean, they did so well. And it's been curious to me that the Paralympic athletes are not involved much at all in the disability rights movement. So mm-hmm. I think that, again, drawing on the success of the Paralympic athletics could really, be a boon for public perceptions about disability in Ukraine as well.
Yeah, well, there is a lot to be done in that sphere, but I was really impressed with that optimism that some of these stories evoke. I was curious if your future work includes the development of these topics that you presented in this research.
Mm-hmm. So it's very interesting that, and I'm very excited about this, actually, that this spring, so spring of 2018, mm-hmm. A translation of the book in Russian is actually being published in Kharkiv, mm-hmm. Ukraine. So that Russian translation includes some new material, because, mm-hmm. as you know, this book was published in 2011. Some things have happened since then, mm-hmm. of course, or 2010, I guess the publication date is on this book. Right, so that Russian language edition includes an afterword, which is an update on the stories of the people in this book. It's called Where Are They Now? And so I track, you know, the continuation of their lives and show how what they've experienced in the last, you know, 5-8 years reflects changes in the disability rights movement and the priorities there, but also really important changes in Ukrainian society and politics. We can't forget the fact that Ukraine, unfortunately, is a country at war, and that, of course, the war is producing more and more numbers of people with disabilities. So there's an update in the book. There is a foreword by my colleague at the Higher School of Economics in Moscow, Yelena Yarskaya-Smirnova, who really pioneered disability studies in Russia. So I was delighted and very gratified that she agreed to write the preface to the book. So that's something to look forward to. I hope to be able to travel with the book in Ukraine and in Russia and give some public presentations about the book in next spring and fall. So that's really exciting.
Well, congratulations on that new edition and on the translation. And I think it's very exciting because this book gives some hope and some encouragement. Well, thank you so much for this conversation, and thank you for your research and for sharing the stories of the people who have incredible inner strength and desire for life. And this research helps to maintain a conversation about love and care, not only in the local context, but in the global context as well. Thank you so much, Sarah.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Natalia.